This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
President Donald Trump delivers his first State of the Union speech last night. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We cover it all on Tactics.
My brakes are on fire.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It is great to be with each and every one of you this morning. I am Caleb Colquitt, and I gotta tell you, last night, big night for the political realm, but if you know the history of this speech, if you know the history of the State of the Union, because of course, this is something that is mentioned specifically, Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, where the president is required, it is part of his job, to give Congress an update on the State of the Union, the way things are going in the country. However, I personally don't like the State of the Union. And it has nothing to do with Barack Obama or Donald Trump or who's giving it. It's just, in a lot of ways, the spirit of it, I think, is the epitome of monarchism. And part of the reason that I say that is, it was originally put in there just to keep Congress up to date on things, because keep in mind, Congress used to not be a full-time job. Of all of the jobs that you could have as one of the elected officials in Washington or a judge for the Supreme Court, the only one that was actually a full-time job was the president. And the reason that the State of the Union is given this time of year is because back in the day, Congress only met for a few months out of the year. It wasn't a constant thing the way that it is now. And so the president would give an update on the State of the Union, maybe include some things he wanted them to work on, some legislation, that kind of thing. So in that sense, there's some aspects of it that are still traditional, that still we retain from over 200 years ago when our Constitution was adopted. But the original State of the Union, George Washington, in his 8-year tenure, only gave one State of the Union address, and it lasted about 10 minutes. It was much more of a general report back then, the way that it was intended to be. John Adams discontinued that tradition because he felt it was too similar to the king's address from the throne. He felt that it was too king-like. And because of that, and because he wanted to get away from that sort of mentality, because keep in mind, the president was specifically designed to be as unlike a king as possible. Even the word president, we think of it as being prestigious now, but back then it basically just meant the manager. Think about that. The leader of our country had essentially the same title as the person that's leading the night shift at a Denny's or something like that. That's how they viewed it. They didn't want it to be this big prestigious thing with a lot of pomp and circumstance, and that's all the State of the Union is now. And because of this, John Adams, he did submit a State of the Union because it was his constitutional duty to do so. But he did so in written form. So he would issue a report to Congress, but he did so in a letter. It's not like it was today with all the TV and, good gracious, the intro last night I think lasted about 14, 15 minutes with the walk-in and everybody coming in and filing in and then the president walking down and talking to everybody and shaking hands on the way down. See, that's not something that a radio guy could get away with. I can't do a 15-minute introduction to my show every single day. I have to get into the meat of what's going on pretty quickly. But with the State of the Union, because there's so much prestige and pomp and circumstance surrounding it, that's what we do. And so there's a part of me that doesn't even like the whole process of the State of the Union. But nonetheless, it is part of what our country does now. It's tradition. And so we'll get into the actual meat and potatoes of what Donald Trump was saying last night. I'll go ahead and give you my overall thoughts. To me, it was kind of a mixed bag. And I'll get into some specifics later of some things that I thought were good, some things that I thought definitely either needed some improvement or needed to be scrapped altogether. But there are certain points where I'm listening to this speech, and I thought it was absolutely phenomenal, mostly the stories that he told. I think that it was brilliant strategically for him to start out with, for example, the Houston with everything that was going on in the disaster areas, Houston, Florida, Puerto Rico. I thought that was really smart for him. When the overall theme of his speech was going to be unity, to talk about the things that happened this past year that were the most unifying to Americans. He even mentioned how just regular citizens, people were helping one another in the Las Vegas shooting and in the church shooting down in Sutherland Springs. And then he started talking about Steve Scalise, who was, of course, shot in a terrorist attack and was able to come back in, what, 3 months, even though he was in critical condition, which is an amazing story. So starting out with that was really sharp. I thought that was a good move for the president. I figured he would go straight into talking about how great the economy is, and he did that pretty quickly. But he took time to talk about that first, so I thought it was perfect in setting the mood. But, you know, of all those stories that I thought were really good and that I applaud the president for bringing forward, the story of courageous Americans helping one another out, because really that is the story of who we are. We're a compassionate nation. We're the kind of people that love our neighbors and do the best that we can to help them. And we saw that in the stories that he was talking about, whether it was neighbors giving up time off work, time with their family to go help people in disaster areas, or whether it was the story of people escaping oppression to find freedom, or the story that I thought was really great of the police officer and his wife. The police officer comes across a heroin addict and he is able to stop her from injecting herself and wound up adopting her baby. I mean, those are amazing stories of everyday Americans just doing what the country was founded on, the idea that we can do the right thing without any coercion from a dictator, that man can rule himself. And Donald Trump even brought that up in the speech, which I thought was one of the highlights of the speeches, because we've actually never heard Trump say stuff like that. I'm not talking about the story specifically, but that line about the idea that man can rule himself, that's something that is at the very core of our national identity, and yet Donald Trump has never talked about it before, so I thought that was really refreshing, a good moment for him. There were other parts in there, though, that I thought were gut-wrenchingly bad, and that was mostly when he started talking about policy points. Now, part of it is because I just disagree with a lot of the policies. I won't say all of the policies. Some of the policies that he was talking about were great, and I'm talking about proposals for future policies. The stuff that he was already talking about with the economy getting better, that was great. I don't have a problem with that. I'm talking about his proposals for what he plans on doing this next year. And part of the reason that I think that the inspirational parts of the speech are the parts that even the Democrats are saying, yeah, that was fine, is because Donald Trump, and this is where my training as a public speaker and a rhetorician comes in handy, the guy just does not do logical appeal very well. And he's kind of an enigma because traditionally, that's what you have to be good at to be a successful Republican. Typically, not always, but typically, of the three appeals, because you have emotional appeal, appeal to authority, and logical appeal, where you try to make a logical argument. That's what we try to do a lot on here, is make a logical argument, form it up, and then, you know, support it with claims that back the conclusion that you've reached. Donald Trump doesn't do that very well. In fact, he's pretty bad at it. And the thing is, the vast majority of Democrats are also really bad at it. Barack Obama was pretty bad at it. Bill Clinton, he was okay, but he wasn't great at it. Democrats excel at pathos, emotional appeal. And that's what Donald Trump excels at. That's what got him elected. And it was strange because usually Republicans are the ones that make logical appeals to people's sensibilities. And because they're able to make that logical argument, people start jumping on. Now, the guy that makes the most logical argument doesn't always win. But what I'm saying is that's something that has always been seen as being a necessity. You have to be pretty good at making logical arguments to be a Republican and be a successful Republican candidate. Not Donald Trump. Donald Trump did exactly the opposite. He has this emotional appeal that somehow elevated him to the top. And I wonder, genuinely, Maybe that's why Donald Trump burns up the Democrats so much, is because he is really good at whipping people up into a frenzy, but also because Donald Trump does emotional appeal, and because of that, he's appealing to a different kind of emotion. When you've got somebody like, for example, Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan could do some emotional appeal too, but he relied primarily on his ability to make arguments. If you've got a guy like that that's making a logical argument, you may not like it, you may disagree with it, but you can kind of paint him as this unfeeling robot, which is what the Democrats tried to do with Ronald Reagan. That's not necessarily something that you... I mean, they can go after you, but they'll go after you in a different way. You'll notice they don't characterize Donald Trump as this unfeeling person, because he's not. He feels a lot. They just think that he's feeling the wrong things. So what he's doing is he's making emotional appeals to people in the middle of the country who have different values than people on the West and East Coast. And because of that, and because he's making these emotional appeals, I think that's why he burns up Democrats so much, is because he's appealing to the opposite of their emotions. So in other words, he's eliciting an emotional response from them too. He's just eliciting a negative emotional response. When you have someone making a logical argument, your argument can make them upset, but not in the same way. When he's specifically giving speeches in such a ways that are designed to touch people's emotions, that can have either a positive effect or a negative effect. And because of that, I wonder if that's why the Democrats just absolutely cannot stand the man, because his appeals to emotion fly directly into the face of what they believe, and that's why it bothers them. So now the question is, before we go to a break, will this speech accomplish his intended goals? I don't think so, because he was making this appeal to the middle, this appeal to unity, and Democrats despise him so much, even when he's saying things that they like. I mean, he made massive, massive concessions to the liberal cause last night, and we'll get into some of the specifics, but real quickly, on DACA, the Dreamers, infrastructure, on trade, on labor, all things that he said in those, huge things that Democrats love, that Democrats have been trying to do for a really long time, he was proposing that they do, and the Democrats still hated the speech because they don't like the presentation. They don't like the fact that it was coming from Donald Trump. And so, unfortunately, I don't think there's anything the man could do that would make the Democrats say, okay, let's give him a chance. I think we're past the point where that's even possible. They despise the guy so much, they're not even really willing to work with him on things like amnesty for 1.8 million people. And so I do think that points out the main problem with Democrats as a whole. They are completely, unequivocally ruled by their emotions and not their sense of logic or reason, because if they were thinking that way, they would probably get a lot of the policies that they actually want through Donald Trump, because the guy's not a conservative. Just something to think about. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The great pillars of all government and of social life: virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back, all. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. You can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. And here's what I'm going to ask this morning of the callers, the people tweeting in. If you want to, this is what I would encourage you to do. Give me your best moment of the night, your worst moment of the night. You can do just one or the other. You can do both. I'm going to do both, obviously. So I'm going to give you my best moment of the night, my worst moment of the night, and then try to break down each and every one of those. So I thought the best moment of the night, and I thought it was ironic that I picked this one, because out of all the stories that Donald Trump gave, they were all of Americans, which is to be expected. That's usually how it goes in the State of the Union. If you use any of those personal anecdotes, stories about different people, they're always Americans because it's an American event. Ironically, I picked the only story about a guy who's not an American. There was a story that he told last night about Ji Sung Ho, and he's not an American. He used to live in North Korea. He lives in South Korea now. He came at the president's invite, and he was a honored guest, obviously, but the guy's not an American. But I think the reason that that story was the story of the night of the guy who got out of North Korea literally on crutches because he was missing a leg and was able to make it to freedom. I think the reason that that was such a great story is because it really emphasized the evils of tyranny and socialism, and it was a great contrast to the freedoms that we have here in America. So the reason I thought it was such a good moment is because it is a very real-world reminder that the freedoms that we enjoy here in this country are not freedoms that are extended to the entire world. Yeah, we fight, we argue, things are not perfect. I talk about how not perfect they are most of the time on the air because that's my job. I'm supposed to point out things that we can work on. And I try to break that up with talking about some good stories as well. But the point is, as imperfect as it is here, as often as we are divided and at each other's throats, we still enjoy a lot of freedom. Maybe not as much as I would like, maybe not as much as you would like, but it is important to remember that for the vast majority of the world, freedom of things like speech and religion, those aren't debated. And the reason they're not debated is because they're not there. This country has a real problem with, in the past several years, taking some steps backward on things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the right to bear arms, that kind of thing. However, these are freedoms that aren't even seen as rights in most of these countries. It's not debated because they're not there to begin with. It's not a question of whether or not those things will be there or not. And so in that sense, I think that that story really helps us have some perspective. And I think that it serves to make us grateful for the things that we have. I really do believe that this is the greatest country on earth. And I think that despite my differences with the man, Donald Trump thinks the same thing. And that's something that we should all be able to get on board with. That whether you love the guy or hate the guy, whether you agree with him or not, the man is a patriot. And because of that, and because he does love this country, and because we all love this country, that should be the uniting front. If there was any part of the speech where I think that people could have come together and said, you know what, we do have it pretty good here, let's unite on the things that we agree with, that was the moment in the speech, I think. Or at least it certainly was for me. Because Sung Ho, that is the story of a hero that gained his freedom and now helps others gain theirs. He lives in Seoul, and he works with other North Korean defectors, people that have escaped the tyranny of North Korea and the Kim family. And that really does remind us that freedom is something to be grateful for, something to be cherished, and at times, something that unfortunately has to be defended. That's what we should really be working for as we try to come together and find a way to do that. Take it, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt every weekday from 9 to 11 only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Philippians 3:20, for our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Let me know what was your best moment and worst moment of the speech. What did you like the most? What did you dislike the most? And again, you don't have to give both. You can give just one or the other. That's perfectly all right, too. And you can do that also at Tactics Radio, following us on Twitter or on Facebook, facebook.com/tactics. So we have no shortage of ways for you to get in touch with us here at the show. Now, to me, the worst moment of, because I just did the best moment in the last segment. For me, the worst moment by far was going into immigration reform. Now, I'm going to talk about some of the other policy issues that he brought forward that he didn't, that I didn't necessarily agree with him on. But I thought when he goes into immigration reform, he goes into four pillars. And I really like three of the four pillars. Because he was talking about ending the visas, the visa lottery, anyway. So this system that we have of randomly selecting people, that goes away and we move to a merit-based based on education, work ethic, that kind of thing, which is good because that's the whole purpose of the immigration policy, or is supposed to be at least, that it is designed specifically to benefit the citizenry and the country, not the immigrant. Not that it doesn't also benefit the immigrant, but that's a side effect. The primary purpose of immigration, just like the primary purpose of anything the federal government does, should be to directly help or benefit in some way the citizenry of the United States of America. So, big fan of that. Big fan of ending chain migration, where you qualify basically just for having somebody that you know, somebody that you're related to in the country. And also, I like the idea of more funding on the border and building a wall and increasing the number of ICE agents. I'm on board with all that. It's the first pillar that I had an issue with, which is granting widespread amnesty to 1.8 million Americans. Now, think about this. When Obama originally put out the Dreamers Act and rolled out what his idea of what it should look like, it only qualified for 600,000. That means that last night, Donald Trump proposed a plan that was three times larger than Barack Obama in giving amnesty to illegals. Think about that. Three times larger than Obama's plan. Highly, highly progressive. And I realize he's wanting to couple the two and do both of them together, but if there's anything that we should have learned from the 1980s when Ronald Reagan agreed with the Democrat Congress, okay, I will grant amnesty, but what you have to do in return is secure the border. And they said, oh, yeah, we'll secure the border, we'll build the wall, we'll put extra agents down there, whatever it takes, but we need to get these people here now. We need to get them on the right side of the law. We need to grant them amnesty, and then we'll worry about all that. And President Reagan said, okay, we'll do this. And of course, what happened is those people were granted amnesty and the wall never got built. Here we are, almost 40 years later, the wall still hasn't been built. So, or 40 years, 30 years, sorry. But here we are, and that promise never came to fruition, and that's the problem that I have with the president's plan. Even though I like the last three pillars, because pillar number one starts off with widespread amnesty for 1.8 million illegals, I have a feeling what's actually going to happen, if history is any teacher, is that we grant amnesty to 1.8 million people and don't secure the border. This is the issue that I have with a lot of people's proposal on immigration. I'm not completely 100% against the idea of amnesty, but I don't even want to discuss amnesty until we get that border secure. That's like, and I know that this analogy has been used before, but it makes sense in this particular context. If your bathtub is overflowing, you don't run and get a mop and start mopping up the floor. You turn off the faucet first. And that's the problem that we have. We keep granting amnesty and granting welfare and granting all these other free things that we're giving to illegals to make their life easier. Again, I don't know why, but that's what we're doing over and over and over again when this immigration debate comes up. And yet, we're not doing anything to fix the actual problem. The border. If we fix the border, then I'm open to the idea of seeing what to do about all the people that are here illegally. But it makes no sense to incentivize more people coming across the border by giving the people that are already here free stuff. And that's exactly what this bill would be doing. It would be giving free stuff. It would be giving pardon for a crime that they committed, and also giving them, as Donald Trump said, a path to citizenship as a reward for breaking the law. So all that says to the rest of the world is, hey, you break the laws in America, they're just going to look the other way on it anyway. And look at all the free stuff we'll be getting. We'll be getting welfare and medical care and our kids going to school and all this great stuff. Won't even have to pay into the system. And we'll be getting it. And so that's why I thought that that was by far the worst moment of the night, because it shows that Donald Trump, who was supposed to be so staunch and so tough on immigration, he's really an amnesty guy. It was funny to me because they panned over to Marco Rubio at one point when he's discussing this. And Marco Rubio is doing exactly what I would have done, which is not applauding during that part of the speech. And it's funny to me because it shows his disapproval. Do you remember back in the campaign where Donald Trump just went after Marco Rubio as an amnesty guy because of his participation in the Gang of Eight? I thought that was 100% a fair criticism. That bill did grant amnesty to some people, and Marco Rubio had to pay a political price for that. It may have been the reason that he didn't do better in the primaries. I really don't know. I mean, that's one of those what-if questions that nobody will ever know. But the point is, Trump went after Marco Rubio for being so weak on immigration, and I'm strong on immigration, and I would never even consider amnesty. And then, of course, his amnesty plan is three times larger than Barack Obama's. So it was a weird twist of irony to me that it was Marco Rubio there sitting in the crowd not applauding, and Donald Trump, who painted himself as this guy that's going to be super tough on immigration, saying, and we're going to grant amnesty to 1.8 million people. There were several other policy issues that I had with him throughout the night. And this really does go to show Trump's just not a policy guy. I mean, he's good at speeches and political rallies. He's good at, like I said, that emotional appeal, getting people whipped up, that kind of thing. He's just not a policy person. Never has been. You could tell that in the debates. You could tell that when he was campaigning. He doesn't know this stuff all that well. I think he's trying. I think he's doing, you know, the best that he can on a lot of these policy issues. But you can tell that he's new to this and he's not really a policy guy. Because there were about 5 to 10 minutes in this speech where he sounded more progressive than Obama. I already told you about his amnesty being three times larger than Obama's amnesty proposal. Right after, this was what was astounding to me, right after talking about how well the economy was doing, and it is, and Donald Trump deserves a lot of the credit for that, but right after talking about how well the economy is doing, he launched into a rant about tariffs and protectionism. And I was saying this, if you were following me live tweeting this last night, it amazes me that he was talking about how great the economy was doing, how the tax bill is going to help businesses and really already has helped businesses, help increase people's wages. People are going to take home more money, not only from the tax cuts themselves, but they're going to be getting raises and that kind of thing. And he talks about all these wonderful things that's going on in the economy. You would think that he would get the lesson that what that means is just keep doing what you're doing, Mr. President. Work on cutting regulation. Work on getting rid of taxes. You know, whittle down taxes even more if he can. You would think that that would be the lesson that he learned from that. But no, he goes into all this, well, we're going to protect American workers and punish companies for trying to go outside the country, and we're going to tax imports, and we're going to have reciprocal trade. He's talking about getting into a trade war with other countries. That will destroy the economy. That's what it's done every single time we've ever tried it in American history. It always fails, and fails miserably. And it was so surreal for me to see him talk about all the great things that's going on in the economy and then say, oh, and we're going to do this thing in the complete opposite direction of what we've been doing. I really do wish that the president had learned that lesson, and I guess that he hasn't. Another thing that was really disturbing, $1.5 trillion in infrastructure. Now, for those of you keeping up at home and remember more than 5 seconds into the past, $1.5 trillion, that is $600 billion more than Obama. Remember, because Obama's stimulus package with all the infrastructure spending, that was roughly $900 billion, so close to a trillion. But Donald Trump's saying now $1.5 trillion. And for those of you who are diehard, I know that a lot of you, if this describes you, you're probably not a fan of my show. You know, maybe there are some people out there like this listening. If you're just a diehard, whatever Trump says is the gospel and he's always done everything right and everything he does is perfect and I'm going to support him no matter what, why was it okay? And this is an explanation I've never been able to hear ever since I've been talking about this particular infrastructure spending package. Why was it okay when Obama did it? Or why is it okay when Trump says that he's going to do it, but not okay when Obama did it? Because Trump's saying, let's spend even more money on infrastructure. Because these same people that are praising Trump for this now were some of the same people that were talking about when Barack Obama did it, how reckless it was, it was wasteful, it's unbelievable how much debt we're in, and he's spending all this money on useless products. And now Donald Trump is saying, let's do exactly the same thing, except let's do it more. They're saying, yay, Trump. That doesn't make any sense. That shows that it's nothing but a game to you. It's not about ideas. It's not about policy. If you didn't like it when Obama did it, you shouldn't like it when Trump did it. Or when Trump is proposing to do it, I should say. And here's another thing, too. Trump was trying to make the case that we have all this crumbling infrastructure. Where is all this crumbling infrastructure? That's what I don't get. Because I'm seeing roads, bridges, all this stuff that he's talking about. I'm not seeing really a problem. And even if I did, infrastructure is a state issue anyway. If a road is inside a state, let the state handle it. It's not the Fed's job. If they got a bridge going from one point to the other that needs some work, let them handle it. There's nowhere in the Constitution where it says we're supposed to be doing some kind of upkeep for the infrastructure of the country. And so I don't understand where people even think we have the authority to do infrastructure projects, much less spend more than $1 trillion on it. So that was one of the big issues that I had, and I don't understand this whole dichotomy with people saying, when Trump did it, or when Obama did it, it was bad. But with Trump, we love it when Trump's suggesting that he'll do this. Another thing that was strange, he calls for investment in vocational schools. Now, you're not going to meet too many people that like vocational education more than me. Not only was my dad an ag teacher, but I was a state officer in the FFA. I was the state sentinel right here in Alabama. And it's actually on the back of our jackets in our emblem. It says vocational education. That's on the jacket we wore to every single event. So I love vocational education. You'll rarely find someone who's more of an advocate of vocational education than myself. However, again, same thing with the infrastructure. That's a state issue. I do not understand where people think that the Constitution grants the Fed any authority whatsoever to build any kind of school, vocational or not. And so, I don't have a problem with vocational schools. That's a good thing. But I don't understand why the president was saying we need to make investments in that. If the states want to invest in it, fine, let them do it. All in favor of it, I'll support it. But that's not the Fed's job. There is no constitutional authority to do that, and the president shouldn't be calling for it. And then another thing that he did that really bothered me, he said he wants Congress to pass a mandatory family leave. Now, this part of the speech sounded like he could have plucked it directly from Bernie Sanders. I mean, mandatory paid maternity leave and all this stuff, that stuff right out of Bernie Sanders' handbook. This is the kind of thing that he was calling for in his campaign. Same thing that Obama was calling for and never got done. And this is what I'm bothered by, that well over half of the part of his speech that was actually talking about policy was more progressive than Obama. And I'm hoping that this is one of those occasions where he's doing it for show, just like he did in the campaign, because he campaigned as, at best, a moderate, who was in favor of a lot of the same progressive policies we've been talking about and he was talking about in the speech last night. I'm hoping that this is like the campaign to where he's saying that he'll do this stuff, but he really has no intention of actually doing it, or at least, even if he does intend to do it, for whatever reason it's not getting through Congress or his advisors are telling him not to pursue it, I'm hoping that's the scenario. Because if these policies that he's talking about were passed, that would be a massive, massive win if all this stuff passed for the Democrats. We would be moving far more in their direction than we would in a conservative direction. And so I'm hoping that this was all talk and there was no actual meat to it. Looks like we have a caller on line one. We will go there when we come back from a break. 860-1440 are the numbers. There are two lines still open.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The name of the Lord, says the scripture, is a strong tower. Thither the righteous flee and are safe. Let us secure his favor, and he will lead us through the journey of this life and, at length, receive us to a better. Samuel Adams.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and News Radio 1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. Now, I've given you the best moment, in my opinion, the best moment, the worst moment of the State of the Union. Now I'm going to give you the strangest moment, because I thought this was odd, and this is not on Donald Trump's shoulders. This is actually a crowd reaction that I thought was a little bit odd. The strangest moment to me was when Trump was talking about how the economy has improved under him, and, people getting back to work, getting raises, getting bonuses, all these wonderful things that are going on in the economy right now, which it is an exciting time in this country because we are seeing America kind of being open for business again. That's something that's really positive, something that you would think everybody would be excited about, but they pan over, of course, to the Democrats, and they're talking about all these people getting bonuses and different companies raising the minimum wage, more jobs coming to America. And the Democrats are there sitting on their hands, and I'm sitting there thinking, they don't want to apply. I mean, regardless of how you think about the president, even if you don't give him credit for it, you would think that they would be able to applaud the country doing well. He was talking about the billions of dollars that Apple is talking about reinvesting in the country. And then there was a really odd moment. He starts talking about how he has, and this is a fact, I looked at the numbers, did a fact check myself, that Donald Trump has the lowest unemployment numbers for the black community and the Hispanic community that have ever been reported. That is true. And I really thought that especially the Democrats in the Congressional Black Caucus that was seated there, which they panned over to, I really thought that if nothing else, that they would be excited, that you would see some enthusiasm from them on that, but they were just sitting there on their hands. And that to me was really surprising. Because I get that they're not going to agree with a lot of Donald Trump's policies, but seeing a low unemployment rate. And so they talked about that a little bit after the speech on, I was watching, I switched over station several times. I think that this one in particular was on CNN. They were giving a few Democrats' response to that and why that was happening, because a lot of people were talking about that on social media. And one that they gave up was, well, the reason they weren't applauding is because, yes, they are actually excited about the unemployment rate for black people being down, but that was Barack Obama's doing, and Donald Trump should have given Obama credit for that. So I looked into that claim a little bit and looked at the unemployment rate. Now, granted, and I've said this on the show many times, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the unemployment rate. I don't think that it's necessarily a bad stat. It's just something that doesn't tell the whole story, because it specifically measures people that are getting benefits, and there are more people that are not working that the unemployment rate doesn't account for. So it's a good stat. It's not necessarily one that tells the whole story. But nonetheless, let's look at just that stat, since that's what was brought up. So you do that. And in January of 2008, when Barack Obama took office, the unemployment rate for black Americans was 9.1. In December of 2016, it was 7.9. So a drop of 1.2%. That's it. And if you look a little deeper into those stats and you're looking at the overall what happened over all that time, you will see that actually for the vast majority of his presidency, and I'm talking like up until about 2015, it was well over 10. Most of the time it was somewhere around the 14, 15, 16 mark. So whether or not you like Barack Obama, disastrous for the black unemployment rate, and you don't get credit for cleaning up a mess that you in large part created. So that's something that credit does go to Donald Trump. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
A Republican representative in the House saying that the illegals that attended the State of the Union should be arrested. We go there now on Tactics.
Just try your best. Try everything you can. And don't you worry what they tell themselves. You're away. It just takes some time. Little girl, you're in a little hot the right. Everything, everything will be just fine. Everything, everything will be alright, alright.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Hour 2 of Tactics on News Radio 1440. And the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. I'm honestly a little surprised. Not a lot of people wanting to talk about the State of the Union. I thought that I'd be getting all kinds of calls. The only one that has seemingly wanted to talk about it was AJ, and he can't call right now. He messaged me. So it's quite lengthy, so I can't go into all of it. But, basically the gist of it was he was talking about how the emotional appeal is to people that really love this country. No, that's right. Now, I hope that I didn't give the wrong impression. When I was critiquing Donald Trump's speech-giving abilities, even though I personally prefer logical appeal, and it's the appeal that I use most often, as those of you who are fans of this show that listen to this show often will understand, I do a little emotional appeal, but my forte is logical appeal. I'm not saying that Donald Trump using emotional appeal is a bad thing. I'm just saying that he uses it far more than he does logical appeal. I'm not even saying necessarily that that's a bad thing, because in the world of rhetoric, the only thing that really matters is did you persuade people or not. And obviously, by a show of vote, Donald Trump was able to persuade more people than his Republican or Democrat rivals. Therefore, it works. And that's the thing about rhetoric. You can make comments about somebody's style and not necessarily mean whether or not it's a good or a bad thing. So I hope I didn't give that impression to anyone that I was saying that Donald Trump relying so heavily on emotional appeal is necessarily a bad thing. I would like to see him use more logical appeal, but that's because that's my personal preference. I'm merely stating the fact that he does it a lot. But anyway, take that as you may. And he also mentioned that there is no president that is perfect. Well, that is true, because there are no perfect people. So if you do want to comment, you want to talk about what was going on the other night, and like I said, and this will be true for the entirety of the show, you want to give your best moment and your worst moment, or one or the other, call in 860-1440 and do that. Before we do go any further, though, I have to talk about this. A person did call in, wanted to give a quick update to those in this region about something going on with our traffic situation. I-65 northbound, there is an accident right around the 205 exit. That's up there around Clanton. So if for whatever reason you are heading north, heading in the Clanton direction, there's a really big wreck there. They're having to send people on a detour. Really, really bad stuff. It's tore up right now. So if you're heading north towards Clanton, just beware of that. And we'll have more traffic updates during the afternoon, as we always do. But just be aware that if you're heading north, there is a really bad accident, and you're probably going to have to take a detour. They're detouring people right now. All right, so let's go ahead and jump into this story about Representative Paul Gosar, who requested illegal immigrants in the State of the Union be arrested. Now, you may be asking, why were there illegal immigrants at the State of the Union anyway? Well, the Democrats invited a bunch of the quote-unquote dreamers to be present at the State of the Union this year because of there was suspect, and of course it turned out to be true, that Donald Trump was going to talk about his plan for the dreamers going forward. And so a lot of Democrat representatives invited people that are covered by DACA to attend the speech with them. And Paul Gosner simply requested that the Capitol Police there go and arrest them, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. If you are a individual that knows that there is something where criminal activity is going to be taking place, it is not unreasonable to call a law enforcement official and say, hey, there's going to be people that have committed crimes at this place at this time. You may think about going over there and taking care of it. And then he apparently took that request also to Attorney General Strange. Now, as usual, when the news of this came out, the left proceeded to lose its collective mind. And my question is why? If these people were bank robbers, for example, let's just say that there was some bank robbing legislation, theoretically. I know I'm going out on a limb here, but just follow me down this logic trail. Or, I don't know, child molesters or anything else that's a crime. And you knew for a fact that these people were going to be gathered at a certain place. Why would it be unreasonable to call the authorities and let them know they were going to be there? Why is it that with illegal immigration, we treat this different than we do other crimes? And for whatever reason, the left just doesn't see it as a crime. You can tell because you've had comments like, even though it was a pretty stupid comment to make, Nancy Pelosi saying we should be waiting to see whether or not illegal immigrants are going to break any laws. Well, they did break a law. They came into the country. That's illegal. They've already broken the law. Or you had people like Luis Gutierrez saying there's no such thing as an illegal human. Really? Because if you shoot somebody, the police are going to show up and arrest you because you've broken a law. That's a crime. And so when they haul you away, you are an illegal person because you have engaged in an illegal activity. I don't understand why the left does not see this as a law. If you have a problem with the law, change the law. Propose a constitution to the amendment or a bill that says anybody can come into the United States at any time. If you have a problem with the law, then make that part of your platform, but don't say we're going to keep the laws the way they are, but we're going to look the other way on this one. That doesn't make any sense. That would be like saying, well, we're going to post the speed limit at 55, but we're not going to actually stop anybody unless they're doing over 95. Well, then there's no point in putting up the 55 speed limit. You either change the speed limit or you enforce the speed limit that you've got. And that's exactly the same way with legal immigration. If you have an issue with that law, then change the law. Say it's okay for people to come across the border without checking with us first. But don't just say that, okay, well, the people that did break that law, we're just going to look the other way on that one. Furthermore, this is really indicative of the entire problem with the Dreamers debate. They act as though these kids, and I use that sparingly because some of the people covered by DACA are not kids. They claim that they came over when they were children, but we have no way of actually knowing that for sure. So some of these kids, they try to make them out as being the top of their class, model student, never does anything wrong, never engaged in any kind of illegal activity, always the cream of the crop. That's how they always try to paint these dreamers. They're really like magical creatures, like unicorns or something, that are incapable of doing anything wrong. Actually, a new study that comes out of Arizona done by John Lott shows that illegals are about 140% more likely to commit crimes. Now, that's not dreamers specifically. That's just illegal immigrants overall. It's hard to designate specifically people covered by DACA when engaging in one of these studies. Honestly, it's really difficult to even isolate illegal immigrants in one of these studies. But based on a 30-year study, the best that they could do out of Arizona, it shows that illegals commit crimes at a rate of about 140% more than native-born citizens. And another thing, too, the qualification for being a quote-unquote dreamer is way too broad, because they basically say anybody that was brought here when they were under the age of 18. Here's the problem, though. They're undocumented. That's what makes them illegal immigrants. So we don't know when they came over, and we also don't know how old they are. They could be, you know, 25 and claiming that they're 18 and came over 6 months ago, or came over when they were little kids. How are you going to disprove that? They could be 50 and say that they came over when they were a little kid, and you can't disprove it because they're undocumented. So that's part of the problem, too. The qualification for the quote-unquote dreamers is just way too broad. And they always make the case, well, these people have never known any other country. This is their way of life now. This is their home. They don't even remember what it's like in Mexico or Venezuela or Guam or wherever it is they came from. But the truth is, you don't know that either. Maybe they came over when they were 17 and they're only 20. They remember their home country very well. In fact, they spent the vast majority of their life there. And yet they would still qualify for dreamer status. And so there's a lot of these false arguments around this particular issue. And they talk about, well, we can't break up families. We can't just break up families. First of all, when a crime is committed, we break up families all the time. If your father commits a crime, they take your father and put him in jail, or your mother, or whoever else it may be, whatever family member we're talking about here, because they broke the law. That's not the intention. You know, we're not specifically doing it to break up families, but we deem it necessary to keep law and order to take those people that disobey the laws and punish them for it. If the family suffers for that, that's a terrible thing, and we don't want to do that, but, well, they shouldn't have broken the law. And another thing, too, that a lot of these dreamers, again, quote-unquote, came over as unaccompanied minors. So, in other words, leaving the floodgates open, offering all this free stuff to dreamers, that actually incentivizes the breaking up of families. So it's not an honest argument. Sending them back to their home country in a lot of cases, not every case, but a lot of these cases, would actually do much more in reuniting them with their families than breaking them apart. So there's a lot of these false arguments that misrepresent who these people that are covered by DACA actually are. And the bottom line is this: amnesty without border security encourages more illegals to come. When you grant amnesty and grant all these free benefits to people that have never paid into the system, never paid taxes in their life, but have come over, and other countries around the world see this and see it happening in droves, that incentivizes more people coming over. Here's where all the free stuff is. We might as well put a giant neon sign on the border saying, this way for free health care, free schooling, all these things. All you're doing is drawing in more people and saying, it's okay to break our laws. We'll actually reward you for breaking our laws. I just don't understand it. We treat it differently than every other crime, and I really don't understand why. Again, I would be okay with amnesty, but if we do, we have to fix the border first. That way, if we do consider amnesty and figure out what to do with all the people that are here, because I realize it would be virtually impossible to deport 30 million people. I get that. But we've got to fix the border first so that when and if we do actually grant amnesty to these people, it's not followed by another wave of people coming in because they're saying, hey, you go to America, you break their laws, you sneak across the border, you get citizenship. It was like Milton Friedman said, you cannot simultaneously have a welfare state and an open border, because all that's going to do is have people flooding across to get the free stuff. And we're seeing that play out right in front of our eyes. 860-1440 are the numbers. We will be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. You can tweet us at Tactics Radio. Speaking of that, if you were watching the live tweet the other night, I also live tweeted the Democrat response. I was not paying quite as much attention by that point, but I got to tell you, that is an absolutely thankless job. So I feel for Joe Kennedy, who was given the task of doing that, because you're on a smaller stage. It always looks kind of hokey. And I don't know, there's just, if you do a really good job, you don't get a lot of accolades for it. And if you screw it up, people remember it forever. Like poor Bobby Jindal, who just took a drink several times during the Republican response. That followed him and haunted him for years. I think he's finally gotten over it now, but I do feel for the person that has to give the response for that. But nonetheless, I was just watching this like, where did the Democrats dig this kid up? I mean, I know this is an ad hominem observation, but he looks like a cross between JFK and Opie from Andy Griffith. But nonetheless, I thought really he kind of missed the mark on that altogether. I won't get into that right now. I may do that a little bit later in the show if we have time. 860-1440, like I said, are the numbers if you want to weigh in and give me your best moment of the night, worst moment of the night. Wanted to bring that to fruition. You can do that at 860-1440. Now, we've been talking a lot about illegals and the situation as it is in this country now. Actually, they are now proposing doing something else for illegals. Now, this is not on the federal level. This is just in the state of New York. But New York is expanding their free college because they have the Excelsior Scholarship now, to where basically everybody in the state gets free college and the state pays for it. They're now expanding that to illegal immigrants, people that are covered by the DREAM Act. So think about this. I want you to really break apart and wrap your mind around this. Break this into a little digestible chunks. It is not enough. It's not progressive enough for the state of New York in their mind to take your taxpayer money as a New Yorker, to take that away from you, even though you've earned it, and give it to somebody else so that that person, probably someone who has not paid taxes, their parents probably have, but they probably personally haven't, to give them something, a very expensive college education, for free. To them, that's not progressive enough. Now they're going to go in and take your money as a taxpayer and give it to someone who is not even a citizen of this country or that state. Think about that for a second. If you're looking at it from our perspective, I hope that a policy like this never actually makes it onto the federal stage, because that would mean we would be involved with it too. That they would be taking our tax dollars, and it already bothers me that they have as many federal programs as they do for illegal immigrants. I'm already bothered by that. But to do this also with a free college education, something that is a luxury, that they will just take your money, a lot of your money, and give it to someone who has never paid into the system and whose family has never paid into the system. Someone that is not even a citizen of this country and is breaking the law just by being here. Wrap your head around that for a second. That's how crazy the left is. That they think that the government should not only take your money, but give it to people that are not even a part of the system, that are not even a part of the government. This is one more reason to never, ever even contemplate moving to a progressive state because of crazy stuff like this. And that's part of the reason that we're seeing that a lot of people are actually moving out of progressive states. We're seeing a mass exodus from New York, California, and we're seeing those people move to places like Texas, the number one growth state, population-wise, from other states, was Texas. Wasn't even close. And the state that lost the most people in the past couple years was California. Because they're fleeing the oppressive policy and the oppressive taxes that their government has levied against them. And they're going to places like Texas, where the taxes are low and the economy is doing very well because they let the free market do its thing. Now, unfortunately, one thing that we're seeing, and we've already seen it happen with states before, we saw it happen with Florida, because Florida is getting, as time goes on, more and more purple into blue. That when people from a progressive state move to a more conservative state, for whatever reason, whether it's whether they're fleeing the taxes or whatever it may be, that when they get there, they start voting progressive. So they start bringing their problems with them and they start flipping that state. Just like what we're talking about with illegal immigration, you cannot take people from there to here and expect here not to start looking more like there. Because people tend to bring, for good or ill, parts of their culture and, when they go to the voting booth, part of where they originated from. Not always, but in many, many cases, people vote for the government services that they no longer get in their new state, and so they bring with them the very problems that caused the reason that they left their old state in the first place. We've already seen it in a lot of the major metropolitan areas in Texas. For example, Austin is about as liberal as it gets. It's a weird little bastion of liberalism in one of the more conservative states. But getting back to this whole deal with New York, they are actively rewarding breaking the law with taxpayer-funded free stuff, now extending that even to free college. This is why people have an issue with illegal immigration in the first place, because it is a group of people that have not paid into the system, that have not worked their whole life in this country, that have not contributed to this society, at least not in the way that citizens have, and don't pay taxes, reaping the benefits of their labor. And it's hard to blame people for being upset about that. You cannot have a welfare state and an open border at the same time. It cannot be done. They will drain you dry. And looking at it from the perspective of the illegal immigrants, it's hard to blame them. If they have virtually no opportunity where they are, their home country, like a lot of not only Mexico, but a lot of the South American countries where these immigrants are coming from, they're ridden with drug lords, crime, very little economic opportunity, very little opportunity to move up. And they could go through the process of migrating here legally, but that's incredibly expensive. It takes a really long time. And hey, the Americans are saying, come to this country. We're not going to prosecute you. We're not going to have any issues with you legally. We're not going to punish you. In fact, we're going to give you all this free stuff. Honestly, looking at it from their perspective, it's hard to blame them for coming. You kind of wonder why all of them don't come. And that's the problem with the policy as we have it. Yes, we need to be compassionate. Yes, we need to be welcoming as a society. I'm all in favor of that. I'm all in favor of legal immigration. But we have to also uphold the law. It's not fair to hold one people to a standard and hold other people to a completely different standard and give them a pass when they don't follow the system. That's a slap in the face to everybody that is doing the right thing, that is working hard, that is trying to gain citizenship, and is going through the proper channels to do so. And that's why you cannot have a welfare state and an open border at the same time, because it encourages bad behavior by rewarding it. 860-1440 are the numbers. I've got a couple lines open now, and we will be happy to take your calls in the next segment. We've got to take a break right now. Also, tweet us at Tactics Radio. We'll try to read those on the air. And before we go to a commercial, I want to mention our great friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, these people, they know what they're doing. They have been in business here for 50 years in the River region. People that I trust, people that this community trusts, because they do a great job. When you walk in, the guys know your name. They're friendly. They'll talk to you. And when you put your car in their care, because keep in mind, your car is the second biggest investment you're probably going to make. Probably right under your house, your car is the most expensive thing you own. They get that. They understand it's important, and they understand that you can't necessarily spend a ton of money there. Every time I've ever been to Southside Firestone, not only have they been able to do great work, but they've been able to do it at a fair price. Never had an issue with the pricing. I mean, from time to time, it seemed expensive, but it was always stuff that I knew I was getting a fair price on because I've been with them for a really long time. I know how much the individual part costs. I know how hard they have to work on that. And the prices are always fair. They're always surprising, much lower than any other shop that I've ever had to work with or that I've given my business to, because they know that it's important to you. So they give you great product, great service at a fair price. So go see my friends on the Troy Highway today. That is Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We will be right back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
I recommend a general and public return of praise and thanksgiving to Him from whose goodness these blessings descend. John Jay, First Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. At Tactics Radio is the way to get in touch with us on Twitter. Excuse me. I actually didn't think I was going to make it back from the break because Kevin left me with a O. Henry bar, which was nice of him. I appreciate that. But I'd never had an O. Henry bar, and so I tried to eat it during the show, and that was a mistake. That thing is chewy. It takes a while to chew it, so was not anticipating that. It's not bad. I would say that Snickers is probably a much better candy bar, but anyway, I do appreciate it, but I should have waited until after the show to try to eat it. Well, you know, lessons learned. I've never heard of an O. Henry bar before, so probably won't be getting it again. I like Snickers and Butterfinger too much, but still, that's very chewy. It almost messed me up, but glad to be back with you. And I did want to mention this because this has gone, in my opinion, criminally underreported, and maybe it's because of the scandal, everything that's going on right now with the Mueller investigation, and then, of course, the State of the Union and McCabe departing, all things that definitely need to be taken into consideration. But at the same time, I do feel as though this has gone underreported. And so we may be talking about this within the next few coming days. Hopefully we don't, because there's nothing to report, because it never goes anywhere. That would be ideal. But there is a story out now about the government has at least been talking about. No plans have been put forward thus far. But the governments are talking about taking over the phone network. So all of those of you out here that have cell phones, I know many of you are probably listening to me right now on a cell phone via either the News Radio 1440 app or iHeart or some other application that you can use for that. They're talking about completely taking over that phone network because there is a race to 5G going on right now. And the two biggest contenders are China and America. So you remember we had 3G for a while, and then we moved, I think, within a year to 4G, and they're developing 5G right now. So they're trying to make the network faster, trying to make it better, but they haven't quite gotten there yet. And they're trying to beat China out for that, which would be good because we beat China out for 3G and 4G. However, there is a presentation by the National Security Council that asserts to do this, the United States should build the network itself. That to make it more efficient and to get to 5G quicker, we need to take taxpayer dollars and we need to start building this massive phone structure ourselves. First of all, that makes no sense because they would essentially be starting from scratch. Because, I mean, I guess they could buy out some of the equipment from the phone providers now, but other than that, they would have to build the network entirely on their own and start over from the very beginning. And here's the thing that bothers me. Because they're talking about doing that and then just renting access to mobile providers. So, in other words, in their plan, Verizon and AT&T and all those other companies, they would still exist. But they would just be buying access to the federal government's property and provide you with services that way. Okay, first of all, does anybody think that would make phone service cheaper at all? Instead of them owning the equipment themselves, them tacking on an extra fee to buy and rent the airspace? That's going to make bills go up. And more importantly than that, does anybody really believe that the Fed could build a better, faster network? Does anyone believe that the federal government can do anything better or faster than the market? Because keep in mind, let's look at the post office versus UPS and FedEx. Now, the post office does provide a useful service. I'm not saying that the Fed ought to get rid of it. It is one of the few actual things that the federal government does that is in the Constitution that they have authority to do. But even so, let's not make the point, and that is a nationwide communication network. Let's not pretend that the service and everything else is better at the Postal Service than it is at UPS. I mean, it's much faster, much more efficient, and switching to a government-owned phone system, that's just going to do exactly what it does to the Postal Service. Make it slower and clunkier, and probably, in this particular case, maybe not so much with the U.S. Postal Service, but it looks like the way that they would do it with this particular plan to rent space to the phone carriers, it would make it more expensive. Also, let's look at AT&T back in the day and look at AT&T now. Back when AT&T was basically the same thing as the government because it was a government-sanctioned monopoly, it was slow, it was clunky, technology took forever to advance. And then once the government got out of it, technology advanced pretty rapidly. Phone technology did not advance all that much from the time that the telephone was invented until, about the 80s and 90s, when AT&T was no longer the only game in town. And then you started seeing people privately own phones, all these new features coming out, and eventually it led to cell phones and so on and so forth until we have what we have now, where every plan is unlimited, where there's a lot of variety. You can go and customize your plan to fit whatever it is that you need specifically, blazing fast. We have the internet on our phones. All that happened in part because the government got out of the way. The government stifles innovation. And another thing, too, they're saying that the Fed has to do this to prevent hacking because China could hack into it if it was a private company. Well, now, China has hacked into private companies in America before. I'm not saying they haven't. But let's not pretend that the federal government is immune to hacking. The federal government can be hacked. It gets hacked all the time. Several years ago, there were people that hacked into the Pentagon. They found out it was a couple kids in their mom's basement. The federal government is not immune to hacking. And I don't understand why they think their cybersecurity would be so much better than a private company's cybersecurity. Furthermore, have we already forgotten the lesson of this past election? Russia tried to hack into our voting system. Do you know why they failed? Because they had to hack into 50 different systems and tried to do it simultaneously, and it didn't work. Because they were trying to hack into 50 different electoral college systems all on the same night. That was an impossible task. Maybe they would have pulled it off if we only had one system, if we got rid of the Electoral College, as a lot of people are suggesting. That, to me, is one of the biggest reasons why we need to keep the Electoral College. But imagine that the United States goes from, let's say we've got at least four major networks and several smaller ones. We go from all of that to having one government system that fits all. Well, then if they hack it, it affects everybody. There's no backup. At least if somebody hacks your phone now, or let's say China hacked in and took down AT&T. Well, everybody on Verizon and T-Mobile, they'd be okay, and you could at least use a friend's phone. If there's only one system and another enemy combatant brings it down, then nobody has a phone that they can use. That would stifle communication completely. So having different companies is actually a security measure. With all that in mind, keep in mind that this is nothing but a massive government power grab. That's all it is. They see something that's profitable, that's useful, that people love, and they say, and all these big companies are making money off of, and they want to get their hands into it. That's all it is. They can use the excuse of this crisis of China trying to get to 5G first. But first of all, taking over the network would not serve in favor of us getting there faster. There's a reason that we got to 3G and 4G fastest. We got there early in part because we do have a competitive free market, that it wasn't the government doing it. And they were able to accomplish that goal faster. Thankfully, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has come out against the plan. He called the idea costly and counterproductive reaching 5G. He said, we'll get to 5G faster if we let the market do its thing. He also said that it is the market, not government, that is best positioned to drive innovation and investment. Keep in mind, this is the same guy against rolling back net neutrality. Cannot say enough positive of this guy. He's a real free market champion. And of all of Trump's appointments, he's one of the best ones. I know that we don't hear as much about him, but he is one of the best people that Trump has appointed. Because he understands the reason we got to 3G and 4G first is because we have a market that is well-funded. And the reason that it is well-funded and the research into new technology is well-funded is because people like the product that they get and they're willing to spend money on it. And that's how those companies get money to do research to invent new technology. And they have to invent new technology to do what? Please their customers. Because if they don't, their competition will. That's why the market works and the government system doesn't. Chaplin's Report is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. And you can tweet me at Tactics Radio. You can do that not just during the show, but at any time, and I'll try to get to be able to respond to that. But for right now, we do have the Chaplain's Report. Paul is saluting the Christians at Thessalonica for their faith and their fervor. They have been great at gathering money to help the spread of the gospel. They have been serving faithfully, obeying the gospel. You have to keep in mind, this is a Greek town with Greek people, which means that they were pagans not real long ago. And yet they have converted, they've gone away from their old ways, and they have become Christians. And not just Christians, but faithful Christians who live out their faith every single day. And because of that, Paul is commending them in the first chapter of 1 Thessalonians. And he comes to this part of the chapter where he says, you also became imitators of us and the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation with the joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. I want you to take a look at the premise that Paul is putting forward here. He's saying that there is a stream of influence that is flowing, because it started with them, Paul and the apostles. They're the ones that brought the word to Thessalonica in the first place. And that they became, as he says, imitators of him. So when these people decided that they were going to do the right thing, they were going to imitate the apostles because they were the example that they needed to follow. And so they imitated what the apostles did, what they said, and they followed their example. And because of that, Paul is now saying, and because of your fervor, because you received the word in tribulation with the joy of the Holy Spirit, you guys became the example to the believers at Macedonia and Achaia. So he's saying, you guys are doing so well that other congregations are looking to you and saying, what's Thessalonica doing? We need to be doing what they are doing, because obviously what they are doing works. And why did the people at Thessalonica know how to do that? Because they followed the apostles. So there is this stream of influence that is going, which is really encouraging. It goes from Macedonia and Achaia. They learned from the Thessalonians. The Thessalonians learned from Paul and the apostles. Where did Paul and the apostles learn all this from? Well, they learned it from Jesus. They got it from the original source. And that is encouraging as well. It shows God's plan. that from Jesus we get this the story, the narrative of the Gospels, and then we're supposed to become imitators of him. It says that Christ is supposed to dwell in us. And by doing so, we can be influential to other people just like the Thessalonians were. We're kind of like mirrors. We can't create light, but with Jesus being the light, we can reflect it on other people so that they can reflect it on others. That's how the gospel was always intended to spread. Our examples of love and obedience, as well as imparting knowledge and teaching others, that's how we reflect the legacy that Jesus had, by having the same love and obedience that he showed for his Father. That's how to be an effective Christian and a soul winner. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.